Remaker's Mark Hidden Gems 4, Violet and Daisy. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Remaker's Mark. Here we are in our fourth Hidden Gems episode about the, how would you call this? Murder, relationship, comedy, drama? Violet and Daisy. With me, as always, are my friends Andy Wicks. Andy, how are you this evening? Bugbear. Excellent. Very good. Jeremy Nilsson, how are you today?
Quite well.
Excellent. Everything's going peachy. Lee Assassination, how are you doing tonight?
Sick as hell.
Alright, excellent. We're really showing up here. Mark Josting, how are you tonight?
I'm great, thanks. Thanks for asking. How are you?
You know, I'm doing okay. This is Kyle. I'm doing better than everybody except for Mark, so I'll take that. It's cool. Don't worry about it.
We can tell no jokes this episode because any bits of laughing will simply lead to prolonged bouts of coughing.
I can't wait to see the waveforms when everybody laughs and then it just like slowly goes from peaks to like sort of flat valleys where everyone's going
followed by some slight soft whimpers.
Yes. That's as close as I can get to reading the Matrix, is knowing when people are laughing or coughing in the waveforms. So this is our fourth Hidden Gems episode. Just a brief reminder about what Hidden Gems are. These episodes are about movies that we enjoy ourselves, but we don't think that many people have seen them. And we did a spreadsheet, as one is wont to do, and we picked movies that we individually had seen, but the other members of the crew had not seen. So we did The Man Who Would Be King, Brotherhood of the Wolf, The Dreamers thus far for Andy, Jer, and myself. So we're in our fourth episode here, Violet and Daisy, which was Lee's choice. Lee, why don't you give us a brief summary of the film and then the reason why you picked it for our Hidden Gem series?
Okay. Violet and Daisy is a 2011 independent dramedy about two young women trying to be all-American girls while also working as assassins. Their last job involves bumping off a down-on-his-luck loner, played by James Gandolfini, who has a terminal illness. One complication after another leads them to learning more about him and even developing sympathy for their victim, which presents a problem. Do they kill him and get paid, or let him die on his own and incur the wrath of the boss who hired them? I forget their boss's name, but it's a really simple name.
Like Russ, or something like that?
Russ.
Russ. Yeah. Played by Danny Trejo.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I picked this because it's one of those movies that I discovered a few years ago when I was scrolling through my Netflix recommendations, and it was one of those things where you watch this, so you might like this. And this popped up, and being a fan of Saoirse Ronan, I gave it a shot and ended up really liking it. And, you know, watching it the first time, it was a very kind of almost quiet movie, which made it feel like an independent. I could tell there was not a real big budget for this movie. And I had never heard of it before. So I'm guessing it wasn't a wide release. And if you look at the trivia on this movie, it's definitely was not a wide release. I think the budget was like $8 million and the box office was like 17,000.
Ooh.
So yikes. Yeah, it didn't do well. I think it must've been like released in a couple of theaters or something like that. But, I've always enjoyed it. Every time I rewatch it, I really like it. I think it's a charming movie and, it's a lot of fun. So that's why I picked it.
As charming as a movie about assassinations can be.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
Our listeners might be surprised. We at this point are jaded enough to know better, but there's some very charming assassination movies out there.
True.
It's true.
This one tugged at the old heartstrings. Yeah, The Professional would be a good one.
Yeah. And Lee, I have to say thank you for picking this movie. I mean, I adored it.
Yeah, I really liked it too.
I'm definitely going to watch it again.
I'm glad. Yeah, I liked it a lot. There was just something about it. You know, it wasn't anything that I, reading the description, that I thought, oh, this is really interesting, I have to see this. But it just sounded kind of, laid back and charming. So, and Saoirse Ronan was in it, so I gave it a shot.
Right on.
Yeah.
So we're going to talk about a few things with the movie here, and we'll certainly give our impressions along the way. One of the things that I think, Lee, you brought up right away is that, you know, this kind of came through at a time in 2011 where it was sort of post, you know, independent movie times as far as like the Steven Soderbergh, Quentin Tarantino, you know, kind of what independent cinema was in terms of very stylized, very unique, very interesting. So it was kind of got... And being very violent while still being character driven got kind of a reputation of being kind of a Tarantino ripoff, and you have some sort of claims against that. So do you want to talk a little bit about why you mentioned that and then how you thought about that?
Yeah, well, I was looking through some of the trivia, just doing a little research on this, and some of the reviews did mention that they thought that it was a Tarantino ripoff. And, you know, I understand that point, but to call something a Tarantino ripoff is like saying, you know, oh, that's something that Spielberg would do. You know, it's like he kind of changed the way movies were made there for a while. So you could say that about a lot of Paul Thomas Anderson's movies. They're not, but I wouldn't characterize them as a ripoff. I think it's just writing and directing within a particular style.
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
I thought that was kind of a weak criticism, but I guess I understood where they were coming from. It was sort of, you know, mixing, abhorrent violence with really, specifically placed humor.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that Tarantino's very good at. But for me, this movie does that successfully, and you know, that's one of the reasons I liked it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think Tarantino, you know, he made genre movies, essentially. You know, most of his movies have been kind of genre-y, sometimes more specifically genre-y than others. You know, like Django Unchained is very specifically genre-y. Hateful Eight is very specifically genre-y. But, you know, something like Kill Bill has 100 different genres in the series. You know, Pulp Fiction is a little bit hard to lock down. It kind of became its own genre, which is why we're talking about this right now. But essentially, he made genre movies that gave characters permission to have personalities and interesting dialogue. So then any genre movie going forward that had characters with interesting personality and sort of, you know, funny, interesting dialogue was labeled with that. So I think he just sort of opened up the floodgates for that. And so I think it could be an homage. I think, you know, he is probably responsible for this movie in a lot of ways, but it doesn't mean that it's a ripoff, especially, you know, 18 years after Pulp Fiction or whatever. So yeah, I think you're spot on there.
He simply, I think, created the... I don't want to say he created the genre because you said genre and genre-y 1,000 times a minute ago, but he maybe created the path that these other directors followed. You know, I made a note about like Guy Ritchie. Some of the Guy Ritchie movies are, I think, in the same vein, that have that kind of quirky, dry humor with very interesting dialogue and characters in a backdrop of some pretty extreme violence. That I think this movie fits that as well. So yeah, I would lump them into more of a genre of their own rather than calling it, you know, a poor ripoff of something else.
I'd agree. And it's, I think those criticisms are probably just done for the sake of criticism. I mean, it is in the same vein, or it's something that, you know, is a dark comedy, and it's something that is violent, but it's also artful. I mean, those are all just things that are part of the same recipe that that people like Tarantino used. It's different. I use the phrase, it's quieter than Tarantino, more charming than an Aronofsky. What else? There's so many other things that you could say to differentiate this one from other directors that have done similar things. It's just, yeah, more stuff in the pool of the same genre. Genre.
As T. Swift said, haters gonna hate.
I think, you know, Tarantino as a, you know, a masterful filmmaker he made those movies work. And I think the thing that can get it the sort of the label of a ripoff instead of an homage is if you don't think that it did a good job of that. And I think most of what comes through in Tarantino movies is not the staging of the violence. It's not the filmmaking. It's usually the dialogue that is written and how it is delivered by the actors or actresses, because in good actors' hands, good text, no matter how strange, unique, different it is, can be absolutely magical. And I think Tarantino did a great job of that overall. I think he hired good actors to read his dialogue that normally, if you read it out loud, would seem very stylized, pulpy, etc. And I think anybody that hasn't done it quite as well are the ones that got the ripoff title. And I thought this was earned-ish. I wouldn't say, like, the more I thought about this movie, the more that I liked it. I came to appreciate it more as I sort of reflected on a little bit. In the middle of it, I had a hard time letting it absorb or letting it kind of wash over me. Like, that dialogue has to. You have to believe those characters are saying those words. It is not actors or actresses reading those lines. Gandolfini did it perfectly. He embodied that character. It was not a stretch for him, you know what I mean? But I think he was absolutely perfect for that. But it's hard when you have young actors or actresses trying to live up to strange dialogue or unique dialogue. And sometimes it can feel like they're reading from the script instead of reading the feelings of their characters. And I think this movie struggled with that a little bit, but I think it did a good enough job. I don't think it was bad. I just could see that kind of being the reason why someone might have some criticism about it not quite living up to that standard, if you will, which admittedly, Tarantino is a super high standard and very few people actually do. So that's fine in and of itself.
I thought that
not valid criticism, though. I mean, it's kind of like saying that all metal music is an homage to or ripoff of Metallica and or Black Sabbath, depending on how old you are. it's influenced by, sure. But, not everything is comes directly out of or responds to a pioneer.
Yeah, that's fair. That's a good point. I think that's just more my pointed criticisms wrapped around sort of the idea of people being able to see it that way. But yeah, I think you're right on.
Sorry, I trampled over somebody earlier.
That's all right.
I was just going to say that I thought that all three of the principal characters, Ronan, Gandolfini, and Liddell. I thought they were all too good for this movie. They're all outstanding actors and actresses, and at times that came through with this movie, and at times they took the dialogue and really made it work, really made it believable, and brought that like Kyle said, allowed it all just to sort of coalesce over you and really made the movie click. And then at other times I just thought that the movie itself, the writing of the movie, didn't do them any favors. I didn't dislike or like this movie. It was just a movie. And I went afterwards and saw that it's a 23% on Rotten Tomatoes, which is probably not, it doesn't deserve quite that bad, but I was expecting it to be in the 50 to 60% range after I watched it. And I was just curious about it, but, yeah, I thought that they all three did an outstanding job with what they had, but sometimes they didn't have all that much, or what they had wasn't super clear.
Yeah, I think that's fair criticism. I feel like they also bit off a bit more than they can chew with some of the sort of plot lines that they let sort of drift off, like Rose. Like, that didn't go anywhere. And the whole, was it that dream sequence where she's landing
that was
a plane
super
or something
weird.
I felt like that was interesting, sort of Vision Quest kind of things that the director had that they wanted to try to put in there that never paid off. And I noted in my kind of pre-production notes here that it's very rare that I wish movies were longer. It's usually quite the opposite direction, that things could be tighter. But I would have loved to have like 20 more minutes just to maybe tie some of those loose ends up and just get to know the characters a little bit more. It would either remove those scenes that are kind of those tendrils of character development that don't really go anywhere, or, you know, take those and run with them. Like, what happened to Rose? What was the story with that? What was the deal? And so that we could find out more about why this person is, you know, damaged while being, you know, an amazing performer at the same time, if you will, as an assassin.
I'm going to contest this one. And not about wanting more of it. I could have had it been a longer movie, but if everything had to be completely resolved, David Lynch wouldn't have a career, right? I mean, not everything has to make sense. Not everything has to be perfectly clear. And this is one that is pretty enigmatic just by its character. And I think it's more charming for it. I do agree that we could get a little bit more out of the Rose plotline. But I would disagree that we need everything to be more fleshed out. Things can be shadowy and still be completely engaging. But for me, it worked.
Right on.
I agree.
I appreciate that. I wonder if they had a runtime limit, or if they, you know, had a final cut that had that in there and they said, like, cut this, we're printing it, we're going. You know, I mean, there's so many variables that can come into play in making a Hollywood movie that, you know, the director might have final cut, they might not. You know, I mean, I don't know where this was in this director's you know, number of films or anything like that, but, you know, it had a smallish budget and it sounds like it didn't have a whole lot of studio marketing support, given that I had never heard of it and it had, you know, pretty amazing actors and actresses in it. So, you know, it seems like it didn't just have a lot of backing from the studio to, you know, really give it the support that it needed.
I don't know if you guys went through the IMDb for this one a lot, but the director, Jeffrey Fletcher, has one directing credit. This is it. This is his film.
That's crazy.
I noticed he's done a bunch of writing, but this is the one directorial project.
He's got a bunch of shorts, and his other big writing project is he wrote the screenplay for Precious.
And got Academy Award for it, didn't he?
Interesting.
You might have.
I thought he got an Oscar for that. Maybe not.
That one won a bunch of Oscars, but
yeah,
nobody really knows which ones. Nobody.
Not even the internet. Well, we've touched on the performances a little bit here. Let's kind of dive in here. I think let's start with the women. Let's start with Alexis and Saoirse. I think they're great actresses. I have a hard time with Alexis Bledel in general. So much of what I feel her do in acting is reading the script. And I know that's literally the point of acting, but I want it to feel like they're not reading the script. I want to feel like it's the character. Here, I thought she was great. I thought that she embodied the character, and I think she had the luxury of having the more interesting character of the two for the vast majority of the movie. I don't think that Saoirse Ronan was bad. I just don't think that she had as compelling a character arc. It was very much like a very slow slope and then a big slope at the end as far as her character development. At least that's how it felt to me. But I thought Alexis Bledel did great. And did you see, Mark, did you say that she was 40 when she filmed this?
She was 40 at the time of this film.
That's nuts. I can't believe
Holy
she's that
cow.
Old.
Yeah,
it's like a teenager.
I thought she was maybe in her 20s.
That's crazy. So she's 40, 47, 48 right now?
Get out of town.
No
that's
way.
Crazy.
And only just starting to look it.
That is nuts.
She's older than I am. Good.
That
Lord.
Is seriously crazy. Yeah. So I was, you know, I mean, that speaks volumes of her performance as well, because she pulled that off of being a, you know, teenagerish, teenage adjacent. I don't know, however you want to say it. But she's kind of been doing that for most of her career. And Mark, you mentioned Sin City being kind of the exception to buying into her stuff. And I agreed with that. That was like harder than I think she could bring.
Time out. Alexis Bledel was 30 when this movie came out.
Okay.
That makes more sense.
Okay.
She was 30 when it
came out. Still, what she numbers? Doesn't look 30. I would argue that she still doesn't even look 30, though.
No, I would agree.
No,
with
I agree.
That. I would agree with that.
Yeah, she's going to be playing teenagers well into her 50s.
Yeah. I really liked her. Did anybody watch The Handmaid's Tale on Hulu? She was really great in that. I thought her role was fantastic, and I think she did a really good job with it. So that was a nice kind of, you know, exception from that sort of young. I mean, she comes off as youngish, but not, you know, teenager young. She's an adult. She plays it. So I really like that. And I think Saoirse Ronan is great. I just really didn't feel like she had quite as much to work with there. What do other folks think?
I disagree. but I also I think I'm reading more into this movie than I'm reading different things into this movie than the rest of you probably. I made a point that I think this movie really is about Saoirse Ronan's character. Mm-hmm. She's the one that has the arc. There isn't a lot of character progression for Alexis Bledel's character. And that's fine. It's called a static character compared to Saoirse Ronan's clearly dynamic character.
I see a similarity to Thelma and Louise here.
I can see it. Yeah, I can see
that. And I can't remember which one is Thelma and which one was Louise. But I would like an Alexis Bledel's character to Susan Sarandon's character, where there is...
I would agree.
That there is clearly some history there that is interesting and we would like to know more, but we never find out what it is. And the character becomes this kind of aloof and hard character. And then the Saoirse Ronan, Gina Davis character then goes through the much larger change, if you will. And they both drive off the cliff at the end, which is a weird kind of a similarity. I thought it was a little forced in this movie.
That was a ripoff. But I guess I like that part of, you know, Alexis Bledel's character, that stuff isn't explained. So that means that for us and for the character, you know, it's not resolved. It goes on. Therefore she kind of, becomes a little, I don't know, timeless, or she's a little more real that way. You know, she's not wrapping everything up. She's going to continue to struggle with it. And that makes her seem a little bit more real, I think.
I think she, going back to the G word here, I think she's more of a genre character arc. You know, if she is kind of what in Tarantino movies would be like the wolf character, like Harvey Keitel is in that movie for a reason, and it is to be Harvey Keitel and be totally badass and then be gone 10 minutes later. But she has to hold down that style for the whole movie. And so I think it's hard to balance. It's like listening to a Fleetwood Mac track and a Foo Fighters track at the same time. Like, as the Foo Fighters are playing, you have a hard time sort of like appreciating the dynamic variations in Fleetwood Mac music, not because you don't like Fleetwood Mac, but because it's quieter, it has more range in it. It's just that there's that much more volume on Bledel's performance, which in the moment I think felt better, felt like a more interesting performance to me. But again, reflecting on it, I think that I can see where the arc went and appreciated it retroactively.
I agree.
Excellent, Bugbear. Good work. So the third part of things here is Signor Gandolfini, the late, great James Gandolfini. And I thought they probably could have given him a napkin that said, you know, person who steals to take care of his family. And he could have just made up every bit of dialogue his own. Like, he's just that good. And maybe they did that. I don't know. Like, the script was very simple for him, but I thought it was very lovely at the same time. Who is it that said that it brought out the feelings in them a lot? Who was that?
That was me. That was definitely his performance was my favorite part of this movie by leaps and bounds. And the relationship between him and his daughter, for whatever reason, I don't know, me being a dad with a daughter, I don't know what it was, that just kind of hit me. Like, it was such a sad point that obviously was hitting him. The way he displayed that kind of emotion and was trying to hide it, or at least kind of just put this very thin veneer of normalcy over things. I don't know. It just struck a resonant tone with me.
Yeah.
And it's even more heartbreaking when you find out what the actual issue is and why he won't fix it.
Uh-huh. So, yeah. And I think that's one of the things that I loved about this movie was that you know, the relationship that develops mostly between Daisy and the guy, as he's known in the credits, that it kind of becomes the surrogate father-daughter relationship. You know at the end that no matter how he dies, whether it's by Daisy's hand or by pancreatic cancer, it's going to be tragic. And it's not, you know, it's seen almost the thought that flashed through my head afterwards was like, it was more of a euthanasia rather than an assassination at that point.
Yeah. Well, then it means so much more to Bledel and Ronan as well. It's not just them chalking up a paycheck or chalking up a hit or, you know, adding to their headboard or whatever. Like it has a meaningful purpose in their lives at that point.
Well, it's adding to their closets, their wardrobes.
Oh yeah, true. I think that Gandolfini was great. in my notes for it, I said his character is written a little bit as a manic pixie dream thief, which is sort of tying back to the criticism of the manic pixie dream girl, which is basically a female character who is sort of enigmatic and sprightly in the hopes of getting a male character to understand themselves better. Admittedly, this is not sprightly. I don't think James Gandolfini could be sprightly if he tried, but it felt like a little bit like you didn't know him. That's fair. That's very fair. That's true. And I have not watched all the Sopranos, so maybe somewhere in there he did. But
I'm sure we would all love to see him and try.
Yeah. Yes, indeed. For sure. But it definitely had that, like, he is here for plot purposes, but damn it, they did such a good job with it that I didn't mind in the long run. You know, I feel like it was very manipulative, but it was like the kind of manipulative that I'm like, all right, I'll go on this ride with you movie. You got me all the way. So there's a couple things that we want to touch on before we wrap up here. One is Andy had a good question about assassin movies with a heart. We've touched on them a little bit, so certainly this one, Violet and Daisy, and we mentioned The Professional as well. Looks like Andy, you added a kind of couple more in there, and then if anybody else has other ones in there to think about.
I added Ronan to the list.
Okay.
Because I think many of us here on the podcast, if not all of us, are fans of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
That's a movie that doesn't emphasize the assassinations. And I think this maybe is a common thread, is that it doesn't emphasize the assassinations as so much as the characters. And we become very interested in the characters in Ronan. At least I did. Why are they doing what they're doing? Why, you know, they clearly have a history with each other. All those kinds of things. And that becomes the centerpiece of the movie. And the fact that they are these hired assassins is almost secondary. Creates a very interesting backdrop, but it is not the crux of the film, a la something like our favorite talking point, The Expendables 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and whatever.
We're just making 5 with an alien.
Of course.
The first 4 already exist.
Of course there's an alien.
And then it looks like somebody added Gross Point Blank in there.
Who yeah,
is, ooh, that's I a good one. There. That's a good one.
And then obviously more of a comedy.
A different slant, but kind of the same principle. Yeah, that's a great reference.
All the murder kind of makes it, you know, a dark comedy.
I would maybe say Kill Bill Volume 2, but not Volume 1.
Yeah, I think that's right on. I was trying to figure out, I noted that on there, and I was trying to figure out the best way to talk about it, because they are very different. But yeah, I think you're right on there. Yep.
Well, why Lee, just out of curiosity?
Volume 1 is strictly about her wanting vengeance and seeking vengeance.
Sure.
Volume 2...
is about while
she's
Bill.
Still on, while she's still on that path, her, you know, the discovery of her daughter complicates things a lot and makes it a little bit more of a heartfelt story about a mother finding her daughter, like
sure,
wanting
that
to
makes
find
sense.
Her
the
daughter.
The first one is very, I mean, even though it's a Tarantino movie, it's very much with the over the top violent set pieces, if you will.
Yeah.
Second one, not so much.
Right.
Good call.
Yeah, the whole journey is about getting her kid back and seeking vengeance, but they're very different styles and ways of doing that along the way. So yeah, that's right on. I put in sort of a tie-in here to one that Andy mentioned earlier, which is that Saoirse Ronan had a really good 2011. She made this movie and Hannah. So I noted that as kind of a you know, an assassin movie with a little bit of a heart in that.
Well, let's qualify that. This movie did make $17,000.
That's fair.
I wanted to say she had a very good action year.
Yeah. All right. Fair enough. Fair enough. Yeah, so I think that was an interesting movie, and I thought that her character was exceptional in that too. So, you know, this, that maybe has a little bit less of a heart than this one, but I just thought that was interesting and a good, you know, still, you know, a little bit of a heart in there amongst the blood and brilliance and Chemical Brothers soundtrack, which is fantastic. And by the way, there's now a Amazon Prime series called Hannah, and I haven't watched it yet, but I'm really excited to do so. So if you enjoyed the movie, definitely check out the series. It looks pretty darn cool, and it seems like it's doing well.
I'd probably also add both the Boondock Saints.
Oh, yeah. Interesting.
The list.
Yeah, yeah.
Speaking of Tarantino ripoffs that I hate.
You didn't like that one?
Oh, I hate that movie so much.
I
need to watch it again. I was totally rubbed the wrong way the first time I watched it, but I need to give it another try. And that's
fine. Who was in that?
Willem Dafoe.
At Norman his Reyes. Most Defoe-iest.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. It's peak Defoe.
And it's peak Billy Connolly as the most badass.
Yeah. I do like Billy Connolly, actually. That's a good call.
As El Duce. Yeah. And then what's his face from Walking Dead?
Norman Reedus.
Norman Reedus. And I forget the other one.
Yep.
The guy that played the other one was the star of the Young Indiana Jones series. It was the other brother. Yeah.
The other one that I would maybe throw out is Lucky Number 11, which is that's probably more in line with the Guy Ritchie-ness of this movie than it is the Tarantino-ness of this movie. But I enjoy it quite a bit. There's a few of those sort of like a bunch of assassins and everything goes wrong and everything is weird and funny and over the top.
Yeah, like I could see one. Kiss Kiss Bang Bang being in there as well.
That'd be another one. Yeah.
And then Mark, you had one that you noted as a weird one, but please do tell.
But Vampire Hunter D: Bloodlust. So this is the sequel to the classic 80s anime. This is kind of left field and technically not a assassination movie. It's a bounty hunter movie, but it's also pretty grim. It's not playful in the way that a lot of these other movies that we talked about are. But it has heart a go-go. It's one of those interesting films where the main antagonist, not really a bad guy, you know, the damsel in distress, maybe not really in distress, and there are some. Well, actually, no, there aren't any like straight up monster villains because everybody's got something that can validate them. Everybody's got something sincere. But yeah, and it still packs in all that over the top anime action and all the stuff that would be really gross if I described it. but yeah, and it's a beautiful film too. The soundtrack is incredible. So it's worth mentioning, and it usually makes my top five movies.
Right on. So the last thing we want to touch on in ending it in a enigmatic, mysterious way is the way that the movie ended. And there were sort of two ending sequences. The first one, Mark, why don't you touch on a little bit and what it meant to you as far as Daisy's sort of arc and Violet's arc and how that works. So tell us a little bit about what happens and then what your thoughts were on that.
Yeah. So I mentioned that I believe this movie is really about Daisy, and that we have all the assassinations. We have the teenage girlness, but neither of those are the point. You know, this is a movie really about innocence and experience, and we see that very clearly with Daisy's character up front, where like they start off with that joke that Violet tells, and Daisy doesn't get it at all. Yeah, even midway through the film, she tries to tell it again to James Gandolfini's character, and
I love that moment.
She still gets it wrong.
The vegetarian.
Yeah, there are all sorts of things where she misses the reference, And it's, I'd say probably halfway through the film, she starts to get it. Things start to click. She starts to be more engaged in the world. And yeah, this is the dynamism of this character. So at the end of the film, you know, we get this resolution of Daisy going and meeting the guy's daughter, April. And, you know, with a really touching move, you know, taking that dress that she bought with the money from this job, which was the catalyst for the entire plot, and gives it to the daughter, April. I'm not sure if we know what she gives her something else too, and I'm not sure we even know what that is. You know, it's probably Marcellus Wallace's soul. But yeah, and then we wrap up with Daisy's character just kind of going for a walk. Lovely fall day in the park. Oh, but then we wrap up again with a flashback to his assassination, where we have a little flashback to an earlier scene of their first hit, where they're dressed up in nuns and as nuns, and it just get a little quick hit of Violet shooting somebody whilst blowing a bubble from bubble gum,
mm-hmm.
and then the credits roll. And it unnerves me and really intrigues me. And I need to know.
You know what that reminded me of is the second to the last shot in Goodfellas when it's just Tommy pointing a gun at the camera and firing.
Yeah.
And then that's it. And then it's Henry and then it goes to credits. That's what that reminded me of.
Mm-hmm. I was in the same place. Right? Actually, it reminded me of Taxi Driver, mm-hmm. and at the very, very end of that movie, the last thing is we get that really split second shot of the main character just looking back right at the camera in the rearview mirror, and it's kind of like horror movie.
Yeah,
and this reminded me of that. After all this nice resolution of Daisy's character, then all of a sudden we go back to that assassination. And I want to know why. It's going to keep me up at night. I think in the notes, I said, what does it mean? I think I used like 17 E's in mean.
Yes.
I think what it's trying to say, and this is just my interpretation, is that Daisy has gone through a change and Violet hasn't.
Interesting.
Like Violet is still willing to go on being an assassin, and maybe Daisy doesn't have a stomach for it anymore.
Mm-hmm. I could see it being sort of a reflection of PTSD of sorts, of all that she has seen, whether she was shooting blanks or not. And she ultimately, I mean, you don't actually see it happen, but she essentially kills Gandolfini. That's the assumption. So she has murdered. Right. And it was a merciful murder. But at the same time, she has pulled the trigger of a gun that killed a person. And so it could be an acknowledgement that having left the life doesn't mean that the life has left you in terms of the scars it puts on your body, your psyche, your trauma. So I could see it tying into that a bit, too.
It could also be Violet killing Daisy.
Oh, could be. Interesting.
Violet did say that she was going to have to take her out.
Yeah, she mentions that.
When was that? I don't remember that.
When Violet first realizes that Daisy has been using blanks.
Oh, yes. Okay.
And she's alone with Gandolfini, and she kind of mentions that, and then he asks her what does that mean then? And she's like, "Well, if that's true, then I'm going to have to take her out eventually."
Yeah.
So maybe that's it.
Yeah. So the thing with this, I think that's a very interesting point. Wasn't there also like a second tag at the end?
There was.
What the hell was that? It was like kids playing, like either making dolls or playing with dolls.
They were all dressed as nurses, I think.
Yeah. I don't, I had, I mean, that, I have no idea what that is. I feel like there's your Rose thing. Like, that's where Rose ended up, and they never told you what it was or something like that. It just made, I had no inclination what that was. I rewound it and watched it twice. I had no idea what that was. So that even put it over the top of, like, I thought the Violet one with the bubblegum was just stylistic. You know what I mean? Like, that felt like it was just kind of a bubblegum pop to end the movie. But I think there are potentially meanings behind it, as we've discussed. But the other one, I was like, I got nothing. I have no idea what this is. Anybody have any thoughts, ideas?
The only thing I got is that it goes back to, you know, the theme of innocence. And it could be, you know, just a comparison of, you know, these teenage girls basically like playing at grown-up topics. I mean, we could theorize about weirder things, like this whole movie is actually just like a fantasy of younger children.
But, interesting. Like, they're playing assassin.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then maybe
after that they play doctor and they fix it all.
Interesting. I like that.
Yeah. I don't know if there's anything to substantiate it, but it's interesting to think about, maybe.
Nice. I like it. All right, so clearly there's a lot to discuss with this movie, which I very much appreciate it. And like I said, like, the more I think about it, the more I like it, which I really appreciate, because most movies, it's the opposite direction. So not only do I want this movie to be longer, which is the opposite of usual, I like it more after I think about it, which is opposite of usual. Usually it goes the other direction. So, you know, go check it out. It is streaming on Amazon Prime, which is where we watched it. So if you have Amazon Prime, it's available. We'll include a link in the show notes. So check it out. Let us know what you think. So before we wrap up here, let's do our ratings. So we're going to do our rating scale. It is of a scale of your choosing. Let's go backwards, if we will, alphabetically. Mark, what was your rating of this movie numerically from 1 to 10, 10 being the best, and the scale of your choosing?
Yeah, once again, I love this movie, and I think I'm going to give it 9.5 stolen gigantic tricycles.
Nice.
Nice.
Dang, that's impressive. You really like this movie. That's awesome.
I love this movie.
I love it. Right on. Lee, how about you? This is your pick. What would your rating and rating scale be?
I will give it 9 out of 10. Barbie Sunday dresses.
Nice. I like it. Nice. I will go next. I was originally going to give this a 6 out of 10, but I'm going to modify that to a 7.142857 ish, 7 1/7. Bloody jumpsuits. So it's gone up since I first reflected upon it. Jer, how about you? What would your rating be?
I would give this a 6.5 ninjas killed with a fingernail file.
Nice.
I like it. And lastly, Andy, what would your rating and rating scale be?
I really, really enjoyed this film. I'm going to give it 9 blanks.
Nice. That's a good way to end it. I like that. Very good.
All of you make me feel like I should watch this again.
I think you should watch it again. I'm going to.
In not my defense, but I guess in perfect clarity, I suppose, I watched it in a way that is, I need to get this done for homework sake. So sure. I wasn't overly invested in it as much as I probably could have been. So I feel like I owe it to myself, with all of you speaking so highly of it, to watch it again in a more more rapt fashion.
But Jer, you like what you like.
It's true.
You do like what you like.
Yeah, there's no harm in not enjoying a movie, and I feel like this series is a discussion of that. You know, like, I loved The Dreamers, and you guys were like, it was fine, it was good, but, like, it didn't hurt me, like, maybe a little bit. I had, like, 2 tears, but not too many. But, like, that's okay, because this was us reaching out and trying that stuff. So these are movies that you love, and usually you love those for strong reasons. You very rarely love a movie because it's, like, it's passive. Like, you love it because it's, like, invested, and so it can go in a lot of different directions. So that is okay either way.
Well, and I appreciate this series of movies because both The Dreamers and this one, I never, they would not have even been on my radar had it not been for this project. Yeah. So, and I assume that Brotherhood of the Wolf was probably the same for you guys. And so I like this idea that we're doing because of that. And so I am glad I watched it. And like I said, I feel like I owe it to myself to watch it again.
Totally. And Mark, remind us, what is the fifth Hidden Gems pick? This won't be the next episode that we publish, but remind me of what your Hidden Gem movie is.
My pick for the Hidden Gem series is a quaint little, mostly animated feature called The Flight of Dragons, made in the 80s, but feels like it's made in the 60s. Starring John Ritter, Harry Morgan, and, James Earl Jones.
Really?
Nice. Wow.
All right. I'm excited. If I can find a copy of it, we'll enjoy the heck out of that, I'm sure.
Yeah.
That one might take some scratching.
Sure. Fair enough. Well, we're willing to scratch. So that's good. All right. Well, thanks, gents. That was fun. Let's close up here. Remakers Mark is a proud member of the Math is Hard Network. To find out more information about this podcast or any other podcast on the network, check us out at mathishard.net. There you'll find show notes with links to all of the people, movies, and links discussed in this episode. This information is also attached to the show file in the podcast client of your choice. You can find us anywhere you listen to podcasts, including iTunes and Google Play, where you can rate and review us, which would mean the world to us. We're on both Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Facebook and Twitter at RemakersMark. Instagram at RemakersMarkPodcast. So hit us up there. Let us know what you think. If you have any thoughts about other movies for us to do, we would love to hear any feedback you have. So, gentlemen, thank you. This was really fun. I appreciate it. Lee, good pick. Thanks for doing that. I definitely not have seen this movie were it not for you, and I'm happy that I did. So, nice work. And up next, we will have Reign of Fire, which is, I'm assuming, Sean Connery's finest work, JK. I know that it's not him. I just keep thinking about that. So that will be coming up in a couple weeks here. But in the meantime, gentlemen, may the Force be with you.
And also with you.